today we're going to be continuing with a discussion on hidden agendas. I'm going to be sharing with you a lot of material on a lot of different topics, just to show you how things occur that we're not always made aware of, and show you some of the scenes behind the scene, to show you who are the players that can manipulate our lives, affect policies that directly impact upon our well-being. Let's begin. This comes, and I'll be giving the citations, this comes from a release and from the David Richardson from Parents Requesting Open Vaccination Education. The law firm of Waters and Krause of Dallas, Texas, announced today that it has filed the first known civil case alleging that the mercury-based preservative thimerosal, used recently in more than 30 childhood vaccines, has caused mercury poisoning many of the children. These symptoms of mercury poisoning are, in many cases, identical to the symptoms of autism, although the suit does not allege that all persons suffering from the symptoms of autism do so as a result of mercury poisoning. However, many children suffering from mercury poisoning have been previously diagnosed with autism due to the similarity of symptoms. Now, this is an unusual case. Children have been exposed to cumulative levels of mercury from the vaccines that exceed threshold safety levels that have been established by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. In many instances, children carry unmistakable evidence of mercury poisoning, and the symptoms of mercury poisoning was first manifested after receiving vaccines tainted by thimerosal. In many cases, children exhibited normal neurological and other developmental patterns until such time as the cumulative dose of the mercury caused irreparable damage to both the neurological and the general developmental process. For example, many children had developed language and other skills that were later lost as a result of the cumulative exposure to mercury. Thimerosal is a mercury-based additive. Mercury has been known to be a hazardous substance for hundreds of years, and its dangers have been well known and documented during all times when the defendants manufactured and sold mercury containing pediatric vaccine products. Walters and Krauss anticipates that a significant number of individual cases against the vaccine industry will be filed in the near future. So this is the first that you've heard of this, but it's not going to be the last, because all these years manufacturers knew that thimerosal was in there, but the public didn't. When you went to vaccinate your kid, and still is in there, you wouldn't know that that you have mercury in the filling or in the vaccine, and that can be devastating to your child's development. For those of you using Viagra, it was 4 years ago on MSNBC that I was asked to come on to debate as the opposing force on Viagra. The show was of such a hot issue that they had me on for 5 straight days. I did a total of 5 hours on the air. There would sometimes be as many as 3 to 5 other people on, all supporting Viagra. I was the only one who challenged it. Well, virtually everything I had predicted has come true. There's now estimated close to 1,000 alleged deaths just due to Viagra, plus a lot of other side effects. Let's add one more to this. This comes from a Ben Hansen. His webpage where he did this research. I have doctors link Viagra to 5 cases of blindness. I've made the statement before that Viagra is a very dangerous drug, and that the only good thing about it is that it will give Pfizer the funds they need to pay off all the Zoloft wrongful death suits, while it remains to be seen which new Pfizer drug will bring in the funds to pay off all the Viagra damage suits. It appears the serious physical effects have begun to surface in spite of the most major drug companies' ability to suppress this type of information. A Washington State man claimed Viagra drove him to attack a woman with a hammer soon after the drug was released. And just finished investigating a case of a police officer who committed a murder-suicide while on Viagra. It'll be interesting to see how many more reports begin to come out as the public becomes more aware of the serious effects of this drug. Reuters news agency, quote, a U.S. ophthalmologist says there appears to be a small risk that men taking the impotency drug could suffer permanent vision loss. Well, Viagra blindness, that's another one. This is a letter to Newsday, submitted for publication. And this involves a man who I've had on, not had him personally on the show, but I brought up his case, Paul Henry Thomas. It says, Paul Henry Thomas's stubbornness, his refusing to acknowledge, quote, his mental illness, is the real reason for the huge and possibly unending number of electroshock treatments being ordered by Governor George Pataki's Office on Mental Health. The depression, schizoaffective disorder, and various other diagnoses given Thomas are merely window dressing. Patients given electroshock treatment for depression usually get only 6 to 12 because each treatment kills more and more brain cells. Thomas has already received at least 60, and the state wants to give him more, without visible end. Soviet political dissidents were diagnosed with, quote, sluggish schizophrenia, hospitalized and drugged against their will. But their brains were not electrically battered, as Thomas's has been. His case more closely resembles the CIA-assisted Montreal, quote, experiments to change human thinking conducted by Dr. Ewan Cameron, president of the American, Canadian, and World Psychiatric Associations. The 70 electroconvulsive therapies, shock therapies, and other experimental treatments given depressed businessman Louis Weinstein left him and most of Cameron's other victims totally incapacitated from brain damage. These psychiatric horrors are detailed in Psychiatry in the CIA, Victims of Mind Control, a book by Lewis's son, psychiatrist Dr. Harvey Weinstein. The Thomas case shows the continuing deterioration of the state mental health system, within which I spent most of my career, from treating patients and compassionately drugging and shocking them brutally. The locking of almost all wards, which at one time were mostly open, and also demonstrates that trend. Signed by Dr. Nathaniel Learman, clinical director, Kingsborough Psychiatric Center, New York. I have made it a cause to try to get Paul Henry Thomas released and out of the state psychiatric hospital. I've interviewed him at length. He's completely normal. He was a political dissident from Haiti. And once again, go back to the concept of what happens if you're just a regular person versus in the main culture who is victimized. You have a lot of people coming to your aid. What if you're in the subculture? Well, you have some people coming to your aid. What if you're in the counterculture? Then you got a problem. And he, because he was a political dissident from Haiti and is black, he has not been given any attention by the mainstream media. So, and there, he has absolutely nothing wrong with him. But that doesn't mean anything once you get into that that whole idea of electroconvulsive therapy is what we need. I'm going to cite here that there are people who defend electroconvulsive therapy. In fact, the Journal of the American Medical Association wrote an article that not only talked about all of its benefits, but really promoted it. And this was in the March 14th issue, recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the Journal of the American Medical Association's deputy editor, Richard Glass, asserts electroconvulsive therapy is safe, effective, and no longer abused, and thus time to bring electroconvulsive therapy out of the shadows. Glass fails to sway electroconvulsive therapy critics. They are incensed that the journal would publish such a questionable report and remain unconvinced electroconvulsive therapy is the harmless panacea he describes. Critics assert Glass's editorial makes erroneous assumptions, excludes important information, and ignores people who have experienced adverse effects after receiving electroconvulsive therapy. They conclude electroconvulsive therapy remains ineffective, abused, and unsafe. So just you understand what it is that I'm opposing, let's take a look at this. This is from Lila Jeanette Kravonsky. What is electroconvulsive therapy? According to the National Institutes of Mental Health, electroconvulsive therapy, sometimes more commonly referred to as shock treatment, involves producing a seizure in the brain of a patient under general anesthesia by applying electrical stimulation to the brain through electrodes placed on the scalp. According to the National Institutes of Mental Health, quote, repeated treatments are necessary to achieve the most complete antidepressant response, unquote. People of all ages receive electroconvulsive therapy, even young children. The effects of electroconvulsive therapy have been known to cause epilepsy, brain damage, memory loss, stroke, heart attacks, and even death. Glass asserts electroconvulsive therapy earned a bad reputation in the mid-20s when shock treatments were abused and overused. He also blames the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for contributing to, quote, erroneous view of electroconvulsive therapy as a punitive, painful, and assaultive procedure used by authorities to control inconvenient creativity, unquote. Quote, that reputation was enhanced by the immediate adverse effects of bitten tongues and even fractured bones and teeth caused by the induction of generalized seizures and the painful effects of electroshocks administered without anesthesia when they did not successfully induce a seizure with loss of consciousness, unquote, he writes. Quote, Richard Glass makes some very erroneous assumptions in this editorial, and it leaves me wondering if he really knows electroconvulsive research at all, says journalist Julie Lawrence, who received electroconvulsive therapy in July of 1994 for severe depression. Lawrence also operates on an internet website which contains a vast amount of electroconvulsive information. She accumulated the articles and journal entries, both pro and con, after spending years researching electroconvulsive therapy. Quote, he lists a few reasons that electroconvulsive therapy is controversial, but ignores what every electroconvulsive therapy researchers tend to ignore, patient feedback. That has been the modus operandi of the entire electroconvulsive therapy industry from the beginning. Although it seems to be currently in vogue to say, well, yes, we admit electroconvulsive therapy was misused in the past, but it's fixed today, unquote, as Lawrence. It's disturbing that such a respected resource as the Journal of the American Medical Association sees fit to describe electroconvulsive therapy as, quote, an effective and safe treatment, given the fact that a significant number of people have been permanently disabled by it. That's according to Joseph Rogers, executive director of the National Mental Health Consumer Self-Help Clearinghouse in Philadelphia. To bolster his opinion, Glass relies on the most recent task force report by the American Psychiatric Association Committee on Electroconvulsive Therapy. First published in 1990, the 2001 edition of the Practice of Electroconvulsive Therapy, Recommendations for Treatment, Training, and Privileging, concludes electroconvulsive therapy is safe and effective treatment for severe major depression. Glass writes that the committee noted that after receiving electroconvulsive therapy, people may experience, quote, a variable but usually brief period of disorientation, unquote, or some retrograde amnesia immediately after electroconvulsive therapy seizure is induced, which usually decreases over time. Glass adds that some people may experience a persistent loss of memory of events that happened directly before and after they received their electroconvulsive therapy. Anterograde amnesia, forgetting learned information, may also occur during and following electroconvulsive therapy, but is resolved in a few weeks, according to Glass. Importantly, there is no objective evidence that electroconvulsive therapy has any long-term effects on the capacity to learn and retain new information, unquote. So writes the proponent of and big supporter and cheerleader, Dr. Glass. Quote, the American Psychiatric Association fact sheet claims electroconvulsive therapy is, quote, no more dangerous than minor surgery under general anesthesia and may at times be less dangerous than treatment of antidepressant medication, unquote, add Rogers. He asserts the American Psychiatric Association wrongly refers to electroconvulsive therapy as safe, practically painless procedure, and brain damage, quote, a myth. Rogers says the American Psychiatric Association minimizes memory problems. Research to the contrary is ignored, he asserts. If the American Psychiatric Association considers brain damage a myth, then it ignores the results of its own task force survey. Some 41% of psychiatrists reported yes, and only 26% said no when asked, is it likely that electroconvulsive therapy produces slight or subtle brain damage? As a neurologist, I have seen many patients after electroconvulsive therapy, and I have no doubt that electroconvulsive therapy produces effects identical to those of head injury, unquote, wrote Dr. Sidney Samet in Clinical Psychiatric News. Samet concluded that electroconvulsive therapy, quote, in effect may be defined as a controlled type of brain damage produced by electrical means, unquote. In the American Journal of Psychiatry, Dr. John Freiberg writes, quote, the potency of electroconvulsive therapy as an amnesiac exceeds that of severe closed head injury with coma. His report, Shock Treatment, Brain Damage, and Memory Loss, A Neurological Perspective, concludes, quote, it is surpassed only by prolonged deficiency of thiamine, bilateral temporal lobotomy, and the accelerated dementias such as Alzheimer's, unquote. One reason psychiatrists are unaware that electroconvulsive therapy is causing memory loss is that they do not test for it, unquote, wrote Dr. Peter Sterling in a letter to the editor of Nature magazine. Sterling, who works in the Department of Neuroscience, University of Pennsylvania, wrote, quote, memory loss could be monitored by questioning patients before electroconvulsive therapy about early events in their lives and then re-question them following each series of events. When this was done 50 years ago, memory losses were marked and prolonged. However, no effort has been made since to routinely perform this simple questionnaire. The late Marilyn Rice, founder of the Committee for Truth in Psychiatry, an organization of approximately 500 former electroconvulsive therapy recipients, was forced to give up her career as a government economist after electroconvulsive therapy wiped out her knowledge of economics. Lawrence says that electroconvulsive therapy wiped out a year and a half of memories before she received electroconvulsive therapy and 8 months of memories after her shock treatment. She believes it's important to look at electroconvulsive therapy from every angle and offers both perspectives on her website. Still, she was not convinced electroconvulsive therapy is an effective treatment for depression, but only offers a brief respite. Glass's editorial does not warn that electroconvulsive therapy can cause heart damage or even death. Last year's controversial U.S. Surgeons General's Mental Health, quote, a report the Surgeon General endorses the use of electroconvulsive therapy, but warned, quote, however, recent history of myocardial infarct, irregular cardiac rhythm, or other heart conditions suggest the need for caution due to the risks of general anesthesia and the brief rise in heart rate, blood pressure, and the load on the heart that accompanies electroconvulsive therapy administration, unquote. Quote, in a large retrospective study of 3,288 patients getting electroconvulsive therapy in Monroe County, New York, electroconvulsive therapy recipients were found to have an increased death rate from all causes, unquote. That's according to Dr. Mario Dolan in The Effects of Electroconvulsive Therapy, a review of scientific literature on the subject. She also reports, quote, the first 3 years of mandated recording of death within 14 days of electroconvulsive therapy in the state of Texas yielded 21 deaths in just the first 14 days. That's according to a report filed with Dr. Donald Gilbert, Commissioner, Texas State Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation. Quote, 11 of these deaths were cardiovascular, including massive heart attacks and strokes. 3 were respiratory and 6 were suicides, unquote. In this issue of the journal, Sackman et al. Report the results of a multi-center randomized controlled trial that addresses the impact of clinical problems of prevailing relapse following a course of electroconvulsive therapy. Glass, who supports electroconvulsive therapy, says that these are not significant. Well, quote, he fails to mention that the Journal of American Medical Association study, patients were given an electrical charge so high, double the maximal output, that special machines had to be manufactured. And this kind of charge is allowed only in research, not in contemporary U.S. practice. Even with that double dose, the response rate was dismal, meaning it didn't help the people with depression. Out of 290 persons who completed a full electroconvulsive therapy series at this high electrical rate 24 weeks later, only 28 were considered to be, quote, in remission from depression, unquote. In his editorial, Dr. Glass adds that some electroconvulsive recipients have reported, quote, devastating cognitive consequences, and says that this should be, quote, acknowledged in the informed consent process. Unfortunately, he does not note that the opportunity for truly informed consent rarely exists now, since many hospitals base their informed consent information on sources such as the American Psychiatric Association fact sheet, which whitewashes the risk of electroconvulsive therapy. In 1998, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released the Electroconvulsive Therapy Background Paper prepared by a research ABLE, a Vienna, Virginia contractor for the Center for Mental Health Services. This report indicated that some 43 states regulated the administration of electroconvulsive therapy. Nevertheless, its authors conclude that despite state laws regulating the practice, quote, physicians and facilities comply neither with the letter nor the spirit of the laws, nor with professional guidelines, unquote. The Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy, for example, reviewed records and conducted in-depth interviews in a psychiatric hospital in Madison and uncovered coercion to obtain patient consent, failure to honor the requests of people who refused treatment, failure to provide patients with sufficient information about the procedure to allow them to make an informed decision, the absence of consent to treat people who were mentally unable to give consent. The American Psychiatric Association's own consent form doesn't even mention the high relapse rate and mentions memory loss and cognitive damage as sometimes rare and nearly freakish. Only one has to look in the courtrooms of New York and spend an hour talking with Paul Henry Thomas, a man who received as many as 74 electric shocks and is fighting against 40 more. Our visit to the courtrooms in Michigan, where it is against state law to give involuntary electroconvulsive therapy to a person who does not have a guardian, yet in the last year, two hospitals and two judges have ignored state law and done it anyway. And you might talk to prominent British psychiatrist Dr. Carl Littlejohns, who is a proponent of electroconvulsive therapy. Last year, he criticized the American practice of electroconvulsive therapy, saying it was not standardized at all and called it, quote, most unsettling. Or talk to the thousands of electroconvulsive therapy survivors who say they have devastating, permanent damage and were lied to about the longevity of the electroconvulsive therapy on depression. The National Mental Health Consumer Self-Help Clearinghouse Policy is that potential electroconvulsive therapy recipients have a right to be educated about the benefits and dangers. Many electroconvulsive therapy proponents, including some cited by Glass, do not disclose they may have financial conflicts. For example, he cites Richard D. Weiner, MD, PhD, who heads Duke University Medical Center's Electroconvulsive Therapy Service and the American Psychiatric Association Task Force on Electroconvulsive Therapy, which petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to lower its classifications of electroconvulsive therapy machines, quote, as a paid consultant to shock machine companies. Weiner designs virtually all the shock machines in the United States, unquote, asserted Linda Andre, head of the New York City Committee for Truth in Psychiatry. Quote, he admits getting money from shock machine companies, but says it's deposited in his, quote, research account, unquote. Dr. Andrew Crystal, director of Duke's Sleep Disorder Center, an associate of Weiner's, who is frequently cited by pro-electroconvulsive therapy journals, received $150,000 in funding from the National Institute of Mental Health in fiscal year 1998 to conduct research on improving electroconvulsive therapy's effectiveness. So here you have it. You have more and more articles coming out in the mainstream literature suggesting electroconvulsive therapy is really beneficial. It's the cat's meow. It's something that your psychiatrist should be doing and you, if you're depressed, should be lining up for. In point of fact, it has no benefit whatsoever on depression. It does not change any of the underlying causes of depression whatsoever. What it does, it creates a massive grand mal seizure that permanently destroys brain cells, that can cause death, and has, that can wipe out large segments of your memory. It works this way. When you destroy enough brain cells, you then forget what you're depressed about. But it also comes back, and even when in this latest experiment, they gave a machine, built a machine that was twice as strong, creating even more brain death, it still didn't keep the depression, the symptoms from coming back. It's very profitable. A psychiatrist can make more money doing electroconvulsive therapy than any other part of his practice. These things can go over $1,000 a jolt. Well, if you have someone in getting repeated jolts, you could make at the end of the year $40,000, $50,000. That's just for you. Then, of course, the insurance will pay another several hundred thousand dollars for hospitalizations, anesthesiologists, and technicians, etc. Just one more barbaric practice, one more thing from medieval times that long ago should have been given up for what it was, utter quackery. And yet, when it's done in the name of orthodoxy, all's forgiven. I'm Gary Nall. Let's continue. This is an article you haven't read. I'll bet on it. It's from Anita Allen, a journalist from South Africa. Let me quote it. It's called South Africa's HIV-AIDS Statistics Problem. Are HIV-AIDS statistics shocking, or are they meaningless? After analysis of the only survey and the cornerstone of all HIV-AIDS statistics in South Africa, I argue the latter. An annual survey of HIV prevalence among pregnant women attending a neonatal clinic has been conducted by the Department of Health since 1990. Its latest survey results were for 2000 were released this week, long after it was due, since this is the most credible source of HIV/AIDS statistics, including those from the UNAIDS and World Health Organization. It's important to fully understand the nature of the beast. It is not possible to relate HIV infection with AIDS or AIDS deaths because HIV testing is not mandatory. HIV infection is not notifiable and AIDS cannot be recorded as a cause of death. Also, it is impossible to plot the so-called AIDS epidemic over time since prior to 1994, the antenatal clinics surveys were based on former provincial boundaries and mostly did not include data from former self-governing states. Nor is it possible to compare the surveys 1994 to 1997 with subsequent years because the lack of consistent sampling frame. What is left are the surveys from 1998 to 2000, which are comparable because only then was an identical protocol, methodology, and interpretation used. These results show no statistical difference. This means the estimated HIV prevalence in South Africa is within the margins of error of previous calculations. Thus, the Department of Health has concluded the epidemic is stabilized and that 4 million people in South Africa are now infected by HIV. The department arrived at this figure by taking a sampling of 16,000 pregnant women at 400 clinics countrywide, which constitute 40 samples each. These actual samples were then used via complicated formula to calculate estimates of HIV prevalence for the entire population, based upon 1991 census figures. They make the following assumptions. One, the prevalence of HIV in all pregnant women is the same as for pregnant women attending neo clinics. The prevalence of HIV in all women ages 15 to 49 is the same for all pregnant women. And 30% of babies born to HIV-positive mothers will be infected with HIV. Assumptions 1 and 2 have no scientific evidence to support them, but the bias is clear. In a sample, 80% of all pregnant women, of whom 85% are black, attended public antenatal clinics. Since few pregnant white or Indian women attend public health clinics, the surveys are representative of pregnant black women only. Therefore, the bias would be towards an overestimate, not an actual figure. HIV tests are specific for detecting HIV antibodies, nothing else. HIV antibody positive indicates HIV infection, and pregnancy does not affect the specificity of the test. Several studies have shown that pregnancy is one condition which leads to a false positive. This is known by the manufacturers whose instructions on the HIV test kit being used in South Africa, namely the ELISA, Abbott Axel Systems for HIV 1 and 2, advises against using its ELISA on sera drawn from pregnant women. Now, this is what's of interest. I'm going to do an aside here for a moment. Why is it no one from any network in the United States has picked up on this? You haven't seen this on Dateline or 20, 20 or 60 Minutes. No one has done this. This reporter in South Africa did it. You see, when you hear that we have a massive pandemic, that AIDS is just wiping out the country of Africa, and that, you know, we're going to have probably 200 million people infected in the next 5 years, at the exponential rate is increasing, no one actually went and say, where'd you come up with these figures? How'd you come to this calculation? Let's see your evidence upon which you're basing this. No one's done that. They've just made assumptions. Well, this is a reporter that actually went in there and found out that you cannot make any of these statements because none of them are scientific. None of it. For example, if you're saying that that all pregnancies in South Africa are being monitored and that you have this very high prevalence rate, how did they come up with those figures? This woman is showing the actual, she reviewed the actual government statistics and found that they go into these poor villages. Why? Because women who are pregnant in the villages and who are poor are given free information and instruction. But what about middle-class black women, upper-middle-class black women, all white women, oriental women? They don't attend these clinics, and yet they get pregnant, and they have a high degree of pregnancy. So they're excluded. Now, they're not coming up with HIV infection. So therefore, to say that we have this astronomical rate of, you know, infected babies, which is what the World Health Organization is suggesting, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund are saying that it's now a national security issue, which then made the CIA responsible for our AIDS policy in those countries. And then Burroughs Welcome saying we've got to get every pregnant woman to take AZT. And then all the world press and scientific community challenging President Mbeki's statement that, no, we're not. And here's the facts. The truth is the New York Times couldn't find the truth with both hands because no one went there to actually look at their what their methodology was. So everyone has been perpetrating a lie. The Los Angeles Times and its best journalists, lies. Ineptitude, and total craziness. Why didn't anyone get on a plane, fly there, and actually do just something right for once as a journalist? Is it possible any longer? Do we have anyone capable of actually doing their homework anymore? Or does that fly in the face of, well, we don't want to get confused between truth and our perceived so-called facts from our official institutions? We don't do our homework anymore, Gary. We just get what we're told is the official position, and then we go with it. The official position is controlled by the pharmaceutical interest, who then control our national defense interest, because now AIDS is no longer a domestic health issue. It is a national security issue. Remember, that's one of the legacies Clinton left us with, making it a national security issue. So now it comes down to, well, if you've excluded all pregnant white women and all pregnant oriental women and all successful or middle class black women who don't attend these poor public clinics, then you're excluding a very high percentage of pregnancies. So you biased your group. Now, then you give all these women an ELISA test at these clinics over the last 2 years only. And you determine that a certain percentage are testing, 30% are testing positive for HIV. But the manufacturer of the test, Abbott Axiom Systems, says, quote, do not draw any conclusions. This test cannot determine that you have HIV 1 or HIV 2. So the very test that we're insisting people take says, do not use this test for determining HIV pregnancy positive. Why? Because it's notorious for giving false positive reactions. In fact, pregnancy itself will take a completely healthy woman and test her positive for being HIV infected when she has no HIV.